The Popinjay Knight, Valentine Williams. 1. I don't suppose you would have found anywhere on the British front in France a handsomer or better-turned-out officer than my friend Lucius. Tall, blonde and blue-eyed, with a fair wisp of moustache, so beautifully trained that we used to call it the flapper's dream, he was always, in all circumstances, faultlessly dressed from head to foot. He used his captain's prerogative of wearing field boots and spurs, and his boots, well fitting his shapely leg and as bright as a mirror, were a perpetual testimonial to the taste of their wearer and the excellence of his servant. His uniform was always spotless, his buttons were never dull, and never did I see him dirty or jaded or discomposed. For his temperament was as sprightly as the rest of him. Every time I saw him, I used to think of that Popinjay Knight who excited the wrath of Harry Hotspur in Henry IV. Lucius was my friend, but when one had paid this tribute to his outer man, I sometimes thought there was really nothing more to be said for him. For of all the decorative shirkers in khaki at the front, from the extra ADCs down to the OCs God knows what at remote bases, we used to think him the most glaring example. And the worst of it was that he was so shamelessly and blatantly frank about it. He had some vague job, carrying with it the sole disposition of a magnificent Vauxhall car in the Corps Intelligence, and when my battalion was in rest, he would often motor over from Corps headquarters and look me up. I shall never forget the occasion on which he openly proclaimed at our mess his satisfaction at not being a combatant. Now, at the front, fellows were very broad-minded. A man kept himself to himself, as the saying is, and seldom inquired about anyone else as long as the fellow did his job all right. This is by way of showing you that old Lucius was asking for it when he started bucking in our mess about being a shirker. We were having tea in some filthy estaminet or other when Lucius blew in, impeccably attired as usual. He started in right away. "Hello, my brave footslogger," he said to me. "I've been meaning to come and look you up for ages, but I wasn't keen on coming as long as you were near the line. There's a damn sight too much shellfire about this sector for my liking." You could kind of feel a frost stealing over our fellows round the tea table, but nobody said anything. I sat him down beside me and got him a mug full of tea, pushed the condensed milk over and the loaf and the butter and jam. I didn't have to introduce him round, for he had been over to our mess often enough before. "Well, what kind of a time have you been having?" he asked me as he helped himself. "Pretty thin," I replied. "We had a lot of shelling during our tour in the trenches and a lot more when we went into support." "Well, perfectly horrible," said Lucius, with his mouth full of bread and jam. "But to think if I hadn't had a lively imagination, I might have gone into the infantry too. I should be terrified if a shell came near me. I'm sure I should run away. I'm devilish glad I had the sense to pick a nice, safe job like mine, with decent quarters, and... Why, damn it, I don't suppose you've slept in a bed for days, some of you fellows, have you?" Now Blinkers, our second in command, a regular officer, out since Mons and all the rest, was having tea with us that afternoon, and I knew that to him this kind of talk was as a red rag to a bull. Out of the corner of my eye I could see him bristling up. I kicked Lucius under the table, but he took no notice and went babbling on. "I've always been able to imagine exactly what being shelled is like," he continued, "and I was resolved that I should have a jolly good try to get a job that would keep me clear of it, so I reserved the infantry as my last string to go into if all else failed." Blinkers had been swelling and swelling and clearing his throat in a way that we all knew portended trouble. "I knew I could always have come to you," Lucius went on. "You'd have got me a commission in your lot, wouldn't you, Billy?" He turned to me with that winning smile of his, so that he did not see that Blinkers was on the point of bursting. So he positively jumped when Blinkers slapped the table with his hand and cried, "And do you really suppose that this regiment that was complimented by the great Duke for the part it played at Waterloo, that fought alongside the guards at Inkerman, that was one of the last to come off Spion Kop, that has gained 2 VCs and 4 DSOs in this war, would give a commission to a cowardly jackanapes like you? Do you really imagine that an officer who glories in a soft job is a fit companion for gentlemen of England who have answered their country's call and are doing their bit? Allow me to tell you, sir, that it would be more becoming in you to hide your satisfaction at your immunity from discomfort and danger, and not discredit yourself as well as the officer who was seen fit to introduce you here." And old Blinkers got up and stalked out of the place. Lucius turned to me with a blank face. "Sorry, old boy, I seem to have bracketed you with myself in the Major's bad books. I really think the most graceful thing I can do is to withdraw with humble apologies for having been the innocent instrument of this disagreeable scene." He rose to his feet and looked round the table. "Especially as I finished my tea," he added. Nobody moved to stop him, and I went out with him to see him off. When we were clear of the estaminet, he said, chuckling,
"My dear Billy, what a priceless type. He talked exactly like a recruiting poster. Did you see him wag his finger at me? Are you doing your bit? How dare I do so enjoy the army?"
"Lucius," I said, "I've always defended you when you put people's backs up by the way you buck about your soft job, but I'm hanged if I'll stand for you doing it in my own mess."
"Damn it, old boy, I was only ragging."
"I don't know so much about that," I replied. "I was pretty annoyed with him for drawing old Blinkers like that. Blinkers, for all his old womanish ways, was a devilish good officer and as brave as a lion. If you've got a cushy billet, that's your affair. But if you really are a funk, you might keep your opinions to yourself instead of airing them in front of fellows who've just come out of the line. I can tell you this, next time they start crabbing you, I'm damned if I stick up for you any more." It was pretty straight talk, wasn't it? And I meant it to wither him, but he never turned a hair.
"Poor old Billy," he said, smiling at me. "You know you'd always stick up for Mary's brother."
"The fact that I'm engaged to your sister has nothing to do with it. It certainly won't prevent me from going straight off to Blinkers and apologizing for having brought you in."
"Dear old chap," he patted me on the back. "So you think I'm a funk too, do you?
Didn't you say yourself that you were afraid of shells?"
"Well, aren't you?"
"Yes, but dash it all, one doesn't glory in it.
Why pretend to be something you're not?"
He was exasperatingly calm, and I felt a wave of anger surge over me again. "It's all very well to pretend to misunderstand me. I know, we all know, there are lots of fellows in jobs behind the line because they have special qualifications. But what special qualifications have you got, apart from the fact you're good at languages, to spend the whole of your time mucking about at the back in a car in a job that any old buffer like a modern languages master or a college don could do every bit as well? Listen, Lucius, you needn't worry to come and see me anymore. I'm fed up." He grinned quite cheerfully.
"All right, old boy. Sorry I made things awkward for you with the Major, but I simply can't resist pulling people's legs. As for my job..."
"Suppose you tell me what your job is."
He laughed. "Mucking about in a car at the back. But we all have our uses, old son. Ta-ta, William. Try and cultivate a sense of humour. It's no end of a help in life."
Then he got into his Vauxhall, but I turned my back on him and walked into the mess. 2. Now that the war is history, we fellows who were in it are a lot of blinking heroes. We bore the young generation a good deal, I always suspect, with our reminiscences of the battles we took part in. But to us at the time, those battles, whose names are now gloriously inscribed on regimental colours and war memorials throughout the empire, were just shows, as we used to call them, and we went into them and out the other side, some of us, without ever realising that we were making history. The weather, the weight of one's equipment, the difficulty of keeping direction in the waste of shell holes, the heavy going, in a word, the petty discomforts of the business, not heroics, were what engrossed us. That's war. And so the first time I went over the bags in the Battle of the Somme, my principal concern was a really agonizing corn. It was in an interval between pushes, and our battalion was in the front line. Opposite us, the German front bulged in a small salient protected by a strong point known as the rhomboid on the right. Before the advance was resumed, it was considered necessary to pinch out the salient and mop up the strong point. The first of these tasks was entrusted to our division, while the division on our right was to deal with the rhomboid. Our battalion and the battalion on our left were to send over a company apiece after a short preliminary bombardment. In our case, the job was entrusted to D Company, of which I was second in command. The staff had the bright idea of arranging for this jolly picnic to take place in broad daylight. We went over at 4 o'clock of a summer afternoon. My corn was hurting me so much that actually the physical pain of walking rendered me almost oblivious of the mixed lot of stuff that promptly came down on us. I know we caught it pretty hot in the open, and I was not surprised to find myself in command of the company as the only surviving officer by the time we reached our objective. Jerry hadn't stopped to argue, and the trench was empty. Our orders were to consolidate and hold on until night, when we were to be relieved. Accordingly, I lost no time in setting the men to dig themselves in. A lot of machine gun stuff kept coming over from the rhomboid, suggesting to me that the attack on the right had been held up. We had a good many casualties. I sent out patrols to link up with our left and right. Then the German barrage started. Those gunners had the range to a T. Up and down in salvos, whiz-bangs and 5.9s came plumping, while a screen of shell shut us off from the trench from which we had started out. My corn was giving me jip, and I had sat down on the fire step to nurse my aching foot, when the company sergeant major, usually the most imperturbable of men, breezed up quivering with excitement.
"Our people on the left have fallen back, sir,"
he reported.
I've just been that far along the trench and barring a lot of dead and two or three wounded, there's nobody left.
What about the right? I asked. The rhomboid seems to be popping off as merrily as before.
Don't know, sir, but I'll soon find out.
I'll come with you, Sergeant Major, I said. 50 yards along the trench, the sergeant of number 16 platoon met us.
They're away on the right, sir, he said. Every man jack of them has hooked it.
Best retire to conform, sir,
suggested the sergeant major.
Aye, there we head, murmured the platoon sergeant.
We can't without orders, I objected, feeling very wavy about the stomach. Then a man appeared, struggling along the press of men in the trench. It was a runner from battalion headquarters. He had come through the barrage and was badly scared. I'd just taken the message from his hand when, without warning, two men loomed up on what had been the parados of the German trench. They wore hideous coal-scuttle helmets and leather equipment over grey uniform. One of them was a big, fat man with a purple face running with moisture. He was wheezing like a grampus. The instant he saw me, he yelled with a strong German accent,
"Ach, bloody Englishman!"
I cried out a warning and, snatching up my revolver, which dangled from a lanyard about my neck, fired point-blank at him. He threw up his hands and crashed backwards with a curiously shrill exclamation of surprise. Then everybody seemed to shout together. There were two or three loud detonations, a louder explosion, and something hit me hard on the back of the head. I saw a shower of stars, then the ground slipped away. 3. Of all the sensations of war, I herewith coldly and with deliberation proclaim that of being made a prisoner is infinitely the worst. A German had got round behind me, and using a stick bomb like a club, had put me down for the count. When I came to, the trench was full of grey-green uniforms, and a party of us was being rounded up to go down to the rear. What with my aching head and raging corn and the utter sense of humiliation that overcame me, I have very little recollection of our march. I know that we traversed a perfectly diabolical barrage of British shells, and I am still amazed to think that we all, prisoners and escort, came through alive. They ran us into a barbed wire compound, putting me in a corner wired off from the men. There were no other British officers there. A German captain, who was pretty civil, asked me my name and regiment and started to cross-examine me in very fair English about our next attack. When he found that I would not talk, he left me to my own devices. A little later, all my fellow prisoners were marched away. The sergeant major, who had got a flesh wound in the thigh from a German bayonet, waved his hand as he hobbled by and cried,
"Good luck, sir!"
I felt pretty forlorn as I saw him go. Gosh, I shall never forget that afternoon. The sun blazed down hotly, and there was no cover. My head was splitting from the clout I had received. I was faint with hunger, for I had had nothing since a very early lunch, and my corn was throbbing abominably. But the thirst was the worst. Some kind of main road ran close to the edge of the compound. All through the late afternoon, the road was choked with traffic going in a dense stream towards the firing line, sending up choking clouds of red dust that were simply stifling. And all the time, the very air seemed to quiver to the throb of the guns. I felt broken in spirit, absolutely abased to the ground. The hopelessness of the position was the awful thing, to count for nothing any more, to be just a captured piece tossed to the side of the chessboard until the game was done. It was not until a deep-throated hum in the sky and the angry barking of the Archies made me look aloft that I got the whip-hand of myself again. For there, very high in the bright blue sky and all ringed round with shrapnel bursts, was a covey of British planes, swift and proud and indomitable, soaring over the enemy lines. I could have stood up and cheered at the sight. It was the stimulus I required of all others in my sorry pass. After that, nothing more happened. It was almost dark when an NCO brought me a couple of pieces of rather nasty-looking black bread and a mess tin of weak coffee. I ate and drank, and then laid me down to sleep on the grass of the compound. I awoke to the freshness of a pellucid, dewy morning. The officer I had seen before was standing at the gate of the cage talking to a slim young German officer with a white and black sash slung across his tunic. When they saw me on my feet, they pushed open the gate and came in. The young officer bowed stiffly.
"Von Scheidemann of the staff of the 161st Infantry Regiment," he introduced himself. "My colonel has seen the bravery of your attack and invites you to breakfast with him. I have an automobile here."
His English was stiff but reasonably fluent. So I am to be pumped, was my first thought. But I accepted the invitation. The prospect of a hot meal attracted me. Besides, I reflected, a peep at German headquarters would be distinctly interesting. "If I might have a wash," I suggested. "You shall have that at headquarters," von Scheidemann answered, and led the way to where, on the road outside the compound, a grey motor car was throbbing gently. An orderly with a rifle standing by the door stiffened to attention as we approached. My escort held the door open for me.
"You'll forgive that I mention it," he said pleasantly enough, "but both of us are armed,"
and he jerked his head towards the orderly, "just to prevent misunderstandings, yes?" The next minute we were off along that road at a good 40 miles an hour. In truth, we wanted all the speed the very skillful driver could whack out of that car. The first thing I had heard on waking had been the whirl and crash of bursting shells. As soon as we had turned off the main road in a northwesterly direction, as far as I could make out by the position of the sun, for I had entirely lost my bearings, we seemed to come now into a zone swept by the British artillery. We had 100 hairbreadth escapes. Again and again, coal boxes pitched with vast spouts of brown earth in the fields alongside us as we sped along, and twice crashed onto the road itself behind us. The road was all torn and pocketed by shell craters, and the going was terribly rough. We had travelled for barely 10 minutes when the car slowed down and stopped at the entrance to a village. Here the road was screened with sacking against observation from the higher ground to the west, where I knew the British trenches lay. Von Scheidemann jumped out and beckoned me to follow him. Hardly had my foot touched the ground than the car was in motion again, backing to turn, and in a second was off once more, speeding back the way it had come. A great pall of smoke and dust hung over the village, and from the tangle of red roofs and white walls in the centre where the houses clustered thick about a wrecked fragment of church tower, the iron slamming of bursting shells re-echoed deafeningly.
"Your compatriots are hard at it again," said my companion. "This is a bad spot. Quick!"
He gripped my arm and ran me to where, above the entrance of a dugout, a black and white flag flapped from a blasted tree trunk. He raised a blanket curtain, and there I saw a very steep flight of stairs lit by electric light, leading, as it seemed, into the very bowels of the earth. We went down together. The entrance led into a very maze of subterranean chambers cut in past centuries out of the solid chalk and extended and modernized by the invader. The place was a veritable underground fortress, nay, a camp. Here were barrack rooms and dormitories and baths and stores, a guardroom, offices, accommodation, apparently for a whole brigade. Von Scheidemann led me swiftly along a main corridor, down one side turning after another, until we came to a corridor bearing a notice board inscribed Stab 161 Inf Reg. Here we ran into a burly Prussian officer who had a pair of tortoiseshell spectacles on his nose. He seemed irritable and rather excited. Von Scheidemann said to him in German, "Things look lively again this morning."
"Herr Gott," replied the other, "it'll be bad for us again today."
"I've got the Englishman along," said my escort.
"Good," answered the other, and continued on his way.
My companion entered the corridor and pushed open a wooden door with his name painted on it. He bowed me into a small, rather stuffy room, plainly furnished, where an orderly was making the bed. Von Scheidemann sent the man for hot water.
"Perhaps you'd like a shave too?" he asked.
I nodded gratefully, rubbing my chin.
"Franz is a man for you then," he said. "He used to work at a barber's in Portsmouth. Franz, you rascal," he went on, addressing the orderly who had come in with a big can of hot water. "Tell the gentleman about the time you used to shave the naval officers at Portsmouth."
The orderly grinned sheepishly as he tucked a towel about my neck.
3 years half I work at Portsmouth," he chuckled. "There ain't many British admirals what ain't got shaved by France some time or another. Good money I have made there, jawohl. A nice town, Portsmouth, and lovely girls."
Von Scheidemann roared with laughter. But I sat in silence and let Franz shave me. I was thinking how far away it seemed to the hard. 4. War is a series of surprises, but I never anticipated sitting down to breakfast with a German colonel and his regimental staff. Yet here I was, in a long, low-roofed room, lit with electric light, ventilated by long, slanting air shafts driven up through tons of chalk and earth above us, eating cold tongue and drinking coffee cheek by jowl with the OC 161st Prussian Infantry. The colonel was a small man, thick-set, with beady eyes, a red neck, and a grizzled moustache. Beside him was the bespectacled officer I had already seen, who turned out to be the first adjutant. There was also a black-bearded Stabsarzt, wearing the velvet collar and badges of the German Army Medical Corps, and a young captain whom I took to be the signalling officer. They were all excessively polite. The colonel, addressing me in very bad French, expressed his regret at having no English, but I told him I could manage to get along with French.
I saw no necessity for telling him that, while I was no German scholar, I could understand the general drift of a conversation in German. I could not help noticing the general air of restlessness hanging over the company. All the officers at that breakfast table looked absolutely worn out, oppressed by the shadow of some threatening danger. Messages kept on coming in by orderly to the adjutant, and with each fresh arrival, the colonel cocked his eye in that officer's direction while not interrupting his conversation with me. The colonel congratulated me on coming through the previous day's fighting alive.
"It was a good attack," he said. "I watched it from my observation station. The creeping barrage was excellently handled. A remarkable man, your General Horn. I should like to meet him."
I bowed, but said nothing.
"But you hadn't a chance once you came up against our incomparable infantry," the colonel went on. "Your troops are brave. They sacrifice themselves willingly, but they avail nothing against our years of training."
Still I remained silent. This artillery preparation for a direct pumping attack was too childish for words. And how they did try to pump me. The colonel, the adjutant, von Scheidemann, even the doctor. They all took a hand and started discussions about infantry tactics, artillery, preparation, Stokes mortars, Lewis guns, and heaven knows what else, flattering me, contradicting me, agreeing with me, praising and condemning British generalship, British initiative, even British pluck. I dodged and slithered and scraped through it all, never committing myself to a direct answer if possible, and keeping a tight hand on my temper lest I should be tempted to say a word more than I intended, for I realized that at the bottom of all this desultory discussion lay the desire to obtain from me some light on the big push which I knew to be impending in this sector of the Somme front. All the time I kept my ears open for any asides I might be able to pick up. Once the adjutant silently laid a message brought in by an orderly beside the colonel's plate, the colonel read it, then crashed his fist down on the table.
"And high time, too," he cried. "Scheidemann is my staff captain. He's not an interpreter. I told the Major General himself that if prisoners were to be interrogated on the spot, the Corps would have to detail special officers. What's the fellow's name?"
"It's not in the message, Herr Oberst, but the Corps telephoned just now. Rittmeister von dem Holzweg is the name."
"Well, he'll be welcome, whoever he is," grunted the colonel,
and started talking to me about the tanks. He was particularly anxious to know whether our people were satisfied with their results. "If you are willing to admit, mon colonel," I answered, "that you are dissatisfied with our tanks, I should be better able to judge." An orderly came in and spoke to the adjutant, who, muttering an apology, got up and went out.
"Well answered," cried the colonel. "I must tell the doctor that."
And he translated question and answer for the benefit of the Stabsarzt, who, it appeared, was inordinately interested in the tanks. The doctor burst into a hurricane of laughter, as doubtless he was expected to do, and the colonel roared with him until the room fairly shook with noise. In the middle of the din, the door opened suddenly. Lucius stood there looking into the room. 5. He was dressed in the service uniform of a captain of Uhlans, grey-green tunic buttoned across the chest, grey-green breeches with the broad crimson stripe of the great general staff down the leg, chapka, the Uhlan helmet, strings and all. An eyeglass was firmly screwed in his left eye, and through it he calmly surveyed the room, whilst bowing stiffly, his right hand raised in salute to his helmet. He was the Prussian officer to the life, impassive of feature, angular of movement. By some trick of the actor's art, he actually seemed to have added that touch of woodenness to the face which is the hallmark of the Prussian officer. His eye rested on me for the fraction of a second as his gaze travelled round the room, but his face remained immobile. As for me, I felt the blood rush to my head and I literally felt my heart thumping in jerks. The room seemed to swim, and I grasped with twitching hand at my empty coffee cup and took a long draught of nothing. Anything, anything I felt to cover my bewilderment. The nerve of the man, the cheek of it all. A voice that seemed a long way off was speaking German in clipped nasal tones.
"Captain von dem Holzweg, 23rd Uhlan Regiment, sent by the Corps, Herr Oberst, they telephoned."
It was Lucius who was speaking in German. Behind him I saw the rotund form of the adjutant. Pushing back his chair, the colonel rose and gave the Uhlan his hand.
"Delighted, Herr Rittmeister," he said. "Have you breakfasted?"
Lucius held up a white-gloved hand in assent.
"Then," the colonel went on, looking at the adjutant, "it's high time that you and I, Gelbhammer, went up to the headquarters of the 390th. If they are coming out tonight, I must see Colonel Krohm. In the meantime," he added, waving his hand towards me, "since you are here, we have an excellent specimen for you to practice your arts on. You speak English, of course."
Ah, oh yes, sir, said Lucius in English with a nicely graduated shade of German accent. On that, after many deep bows and much saluting, the colonel picked up his steel helmet and riding crop from a chair and stumped out, the adjutant at his heels. The rest of the party, with the exception of von Scheidemann and Lucius, followed suit. These two last were conferring in an undertone in a corner.
We can use the colonel's room, von Scheidemann said presently. He won't be back before 2 or 3 o'clock this afternoon. It's the second door on the left. Perhaps you'll take our friend in there. I'll just go along to the office and get the forms. I shan't be a minute.
He led the way out into the corridor, and pushing a door open, showed us a small room with the usual long, slanting air shaft, with plain deal walls covered with maps and plain, roughly carpentered deal table and chairs. On the wall was a telephone. As we went into the room, I noticed a sentry just turning a bend in the corridor. I wondered if he was always on duty outside the CO's room or whether he was posted for my benefit. Von Scheidemann clanked off down the corridor, leaving us alone. I observed that he left the door open and that Lucius made no attempt to shut it.
Cigarette,
said Lucius, handing me his case. As I stretched across to take it, he whispered swiftly,
Don't ask questions. Don't be surprised at anything. Just sit down at the table there and listen to me. When I stop talking, answer anything, anything banal and unsuspicious.
He walked back to the door, and with his back to me and his face towards the door, began studying a map hanging on the wall. Then he spoke in a rapid undertone.
Billy, old man, I'm right plumb up against it this time. It's 8 o'clock now, and I've got just 1 hour and a quarter before the man I am impersonating can turn up. I packed his car, and he can't possibly get here before 9:15, I think. If he turns up before that time, then I'm dished. Look out!
A step sounding on the echoing timbers of the corridor.
It entirely depends on the visibility prevailing at the time, I said quite irrelevantly as the sentry hove into view in the opening of the door.
Himmel sacrament, swore Lucius in German. Did one ever hear such lies?
Then he went into English and his voice was loud and clear.
You must know that weather conditions have nothing to do with the use of tanks. Isol,
he added in German. On that he switched back into English in the same rapid undertone as before.
I should have got clear of the German lines last night, only I was held up. By a miraculous chance, I stumbled upon this man Holzweg's special mission to these headquarters, so I made for this point. It's my only chance to get clear away, but a slender one at that. Billy, do you know where you are?
I shook my head. Then hearing the sentry again, I took up the thread of my imaginary interrogation until the man had passed the door once more.
In front of this village, Lucius went on, is the Stettiner Redoubt. I dare say you know it.
Know it, I should say I did. The toughest nut to crack on the whole of this part of the enemy line, a fortress bristling with machine guns that hitherto defied all attempts at capture.
Our fellows are attacking it at 8. No preliminary bombardment, but full orchestra when they pop. Hark, they're off.
I listened for the roar of guns, but heard nothing. Only I suddenly noticed that the atmosphere was vibrating and that the timber of the air shafts, of floors and walls and ceilings, was oscillating as leaves shaken by the wind.
The village where we are now is the final objective. Our lads are due to be here about 9:05. If they take the Stettiner Redoubt, they should get here all right. If they're held up, well, I shall be properly for it, for no power on earth can prevent my being unmasked. That's the whole bag of tricks, Lucius concluded, and you and I must make it our business to prolong our sitting with Scheidemann here until 9:05 at all costs. After that, it doesn't matter much what happens.
But Holzweg, I queried in a whisper, won't he wire through and have you laid by the heels?
I left him tied up in a barn in a fairly desolate region at least 3 miles from the nearest unit. There is always the chance that he might be able to attract the notice of a passing car, but I'm risking that. One must hazard something in this game.
Then there was a step in the corridor and Scheidemann came in. He looked very harassed. As he entered, Lucius very swiftly and almost imperceptibly got between him and the door.
Can we start the examination of this officer? Lucius said in an annoyed kind of voice. I seem to have been kept waiting for a very long time.
You will not be able to examine this officer, Herr Rittmeister, Scheidemann answered coldly. There has been a telephone message about you.
About me?
Said Lucius, who was standing, legs apart, hands behind his back in front of the door.
Yes, if you will come with me to the office, I will show you the message.
The staff captain stepped towards the door and Lucius stood aside to let him pass. As von Scheidemann drew level with him, however, Lucius raised his right arm like a flag. Something descended heavily on the Prussian's head and he crashed backwards into me.
Catch him, cried Lucius in a hoarse whisper,
but I had forestalled him. The staff captain was prostrate in my arms. We laid him down on the floor. I looked inquiringly at Lucius.
He appeared to be listening intently. From within now reverberated distinctly the rumble and thud of artillery, but blended with it the trample of feet echoing along the subterranean passages, hoarse cries and commands. Then flying footsteps came along the corridor. Lucius sprang forward and put his weight against the door. Someone rattled the handle.
"Herr Hauptmann! Herr Hauptmann!"
a voice cried, raucous with excitement.
"They're all retreating! Zurück! Zurück!"
The door handle was twisted vainly for a second or two. We could hear the unseen messenger breathing heavily at the other side of the door. Peering over Lucius's shoulder, I looked at his watch. It pointed to 8 o'clock. I shook Lucius by the arm, pointing. He stared at the watch, then grinned cheerfully up in my face.
"Stopped, by God!" he said.
Hardly had he uttered the words when a loud detonation rang out quite close at hand, followed by another and another.
"Bombs," I whispered. "They're here, they're here!"
The heavy breathing at the keyhole stopped. I heard a sharp cry of astonishment, a shout, a loud report, a heavy thud. And then the whole of that vast rabbit warren seemed to break out in long reverberations of noise. Bombs crashed, shots pinged through the echoing spaces, voices shouted in a medley of languages, and there was a great blowing of whistles. Then I heard a voice say at the very door of our room, and the voice was the voice of Lancashire.
"Here be another of them, lads,"
and a rifle butt smashed through the panels of the door. Lucius turned to me with a smile. "You see, I have my uses, Billy boy," he said. I motioned to him to stand behind me, then plucked the door wide. The next moment, the little tomb-like place was full with a jostling, steel-helmeted, blood-stained, begrimed mass of British soldiers. 6. Lucius wanted a lot of explaining. I met a fellow I knew in the little crowd that had squeezed out this nest, and he went bail for me. But nothing I could say availed to get permission for old Lucius to accompany me down to the rear. So I left him in charge of a corporal's guard, waiting for some divisional brass hat to come and interrogate him. In the midst of all that khaki, I must say old Lucius looked his part.
"Not a word to anyone,"
was his parting injunction to me. I was sorely tempted to disobey him when, 6 weeks later, he came to see me. Our division was again in rest, and one afternoon Lucius turned up in his Vauxhall, spruce and immaculate as ever. I ran into him at the door of the mess, where he was inquiring for me. Whilst we stood and chatted, old Blinkers passed along the village street. He recognised Lucius at once, and there was the unspoken reproach of Shirker in every line of the cold scrutiny of his glance. I was about to speak when Lucius squeezed my arm.
"Don't spoil my joke," he pleaded.
So I held my peace, and we both went in to lunch.